for Mr. Donovan.
May it please the court and opposing counsel, I'm Chris Donovan and I represent Johnny Taylor. The underlying indictment in this case should be dismissed and retrial should be barred because mistrial was improperly declared in the first trial. As this court has stated, mistrial can only occur in two circumstances: if the defendant consents to the mistrial or if the judge finds that manifest necessity required mistrial.
Why didn't the second one apply here when the judge did everything but utter those words? He looks at all the factors that are pertinent to manifest necessity. He's got a note from the jury. They tell him they're deadlocked, et cetera, et cetera. So
well, I would argue that
really
he didn't
need the judge to say, I am hereby finding manifest necessity.
Not only did he not say those words, but he also didn't do, to me, two other easy things that he could have done to make sure that that was the right decision. One, he should have questioned the jury, either individually or collectively, as Bierski directs. Or two, he could have reread the Silver instruction. And this court has stated that the Silver instruction is perfectly content neutral. It carries no plausible potential for coercing the jury, and that could have broken the deadlock. So I think
But defense counsel wasn't arguing for that. It was the government who was saying, "Oh, you know, we could reread the Silver instructions." So
that's correct. Defense counsel, you know, did basically agree with the judge that mistrial was appropriate. This is where I think it comes into play that Mr. Taylor did not consent. There's no indication at all in the record that Mr. Taylor was even consulted on this important.
Why on earth would he have gone against his lawyer's recommendation and opposed the mistrial? What would that be?
I think it's because he has a valued right to have his trial completed.
No. Be realistic for a moment. What would cause a defendant to disagree with his lawyer about a mistrial?
Well, it's the same reason that a defendant could decide to plead guilty if his lawyer is telling him he has a good trial defense. The same reason that a defendant decides to take an appeal.
What are these reasons for this irrational conduct?
I don't know if it would be irrational. He could have sat there and just thought that the jury was receptive to his case. He knows that they've been out for near 10 hours. He has to have a thought that clearly they're carefully considering this and they're.
Set that opinion against his lawyer. Does that make any sense?
I think it does make sense. I think defendants set their opinion against their lawyer all the time.
Do you think that's sensible of them?
I don't know if it's sensible, but it's a right that they have to do. And I am arguing that a right to consent to a mistrial is just as fundamental and just as critical as the right to an appeal.
But he didn't have to consent to it. I mean, the judge can declare a mistrial without.
That's correct. That's correct. But then I'm arguing that the judge abused his discretion by, if he did declare manifest necessity, which again, he didn't use those words, his application of the Vicita factors were an abuse of discretion, again, because he had these two alternatives that he could have easily done to get a better gauge on the.
But he had three alternatives: do what he did or re-give the instruction.
That's correct. That's correct. And I felt like he didn't explore or do other options before making this drastic step of ending this trial that Mr. Taylor has an extreme interest in completing.
It must have seemed that the jury was being a little nutty, right? This flowchart business, what's that about?
I think that shows that they were carefully considering all the evidence.
Flowcharts figure in the trial. I don't get that. What do they mean by that?
Well, the only reference from the flowcharts is from the jury note itself.
What does it mean?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Do you know what a flowchart is?
I would assume that it meant they had an easel and a marker back in the jury room. They might have been plotting out evidence and writing out timelines.
What is a flowchart?
I don't know.
You don't know what a flowchart is?
Not in this context. I'm not sure exactly what the flowchart would mean.
Could we turn to Mary Weaver for a minute?
Yes.
Because it does seem to me, the government argues that there are a variety of ways in which her evidence could have come in consistent with the hearsay rules. And as I understand it, your response is that's all well and good, but there's still a confrontation
exactly.
clause problem. But aren't we dealing here with plain error review, in which case we would be looking at the entirety of the evidence anyway?
That's correct. But in this case, I believe that she was half the evidence of what put Mr. Taylor with a gun. And so I believe that when you have half the evidence coming in and she wasn't subject to cross-examination, the jury didn't get to judge her demeanor, the jury didn't get to assess her credibility,
Suppose the police officer had come and the government, since for whatever reason they didn't call Mary Weaver, or she didn't show up in the second trial, I don't know what happened, But suppose the police officers just said, we got a call to come to a house at a certain address, and we went there. And then when we got there, we walked across the street, and we saw the person who turned out to be Mr. Taylor. And we saw, and they just don't explain anything about why. You wouldn't have any confrontation clause problem at that point. The officer is just testifying as to what he did.
Correct.
Okay. So how is that case any different from this one? It still takes him over to Mr. Taylor. It still begins the discussion with Dowell.
It
doesn't happen to be telling the jury that the reason he's doing all of this is because of what Mary Weaver said.
It's different because in that case, they only hear that Mr. Taylor had a gun from Mario Dowell, which is only one witness as opposed to two. And Mario Dowell had a lot of his own problems in this case. He had a heroin addiction, which they went into a lot on direct and cross-examination. He initially lied to the police about receiving the gun from Mr. Taylor and then changes his story. So he's got a lot of issues that if it was only him the jury heard about the gun from, they might have discredited it. But then they also get the story that Mary Weaver says he has a gun. But again, Mary Weaver's not up there to assess her demeanor, credibility, and consistency. The government got the benefit of her saying Johnny Taylor had a gun 14 times in testimony, and an additional 8 times between the opening and closing arguments, and then once in a jury instruction.
Didn't defense counsel use her testimony as well?
Yes, he did.
So I
believe,
yeah.
And again, I don't know this. I'm proffering this to the court. I believe it's because he anticipated she would testify because she did testify in the first trial. It's not clear from the record why she didn't testify. I can guess that it was maybe because she wasn't a good witness in the first trial. Maybe the government felt that's why. It was
you're saying
jury.
She was a terrific witness for them in the first trial, since she's reinforcing this gun testimony.
That could be the other interpretation, but again, that she wasn't called for some reason. Maybe the government can enlighten this panel on that.
Okay.
I'll save the rest of my time, I guess, okay, for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Donovan. Mr. Norwood?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. First, with respect to the issue of the mistrial, one thing to keep in mind, first of all, I don't think this Court's case authority says the defendant himself has to consent. I think that in the, for example, the case, I wrote it down here, the Crawford case, it was the attorney making representations for the defendant. The only case where the defendant, where I saw the defendant was actually asked whether he consented to the mistrial was the Combs case, and that involved an issue of conflict-free attorney. Regardless, there was obviously manifest necessity in this case. We had a hung jury after first day of deliberations to deliberate for an hour. They had a full day the second day. During that second day, they sent out a note indicating that they were deadlocked. They then sent out another note saying they would try to work the next morning. They came in the next morning and said they've been deadlocked since day one. No juror had changed their mind since day one. They didn't see that anything would change their minds. And the other thing that Chief Judge Herndon had that the attorneys did not have was Judge Herndon actually saw the split in the case. The note actually has the split. I believe it's 8 guilty, 4 not guilty. So Chief Judge Herndon now has this issue, do I reread the Silver instruction? And then if there's a guilty verdict, then we have another issue on appeal, which is that the jury was coerced into making its decision when he saw the actual split. Chief Judge Herndon did the correct thing, and it was the thing the defense attorney at trial wanted, and that was a mistrial and have a second trial involving this case.
Almost a rule of thumb when you have 6 hours of testimony and
10 hours of deliberations. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind that this was a felon in possession case in which two of the elements were stipulated to, so the only issue was the possession of the gun.
So why wasn't Mary Weaver called in the second trial? I mean, I'm very troubled about the confrontation clause angle of this, less so the actual hearsay rules, since I can see how you might bring it in to establish the course of an investigation or something like that. But
with respect.
Why?
Yeah. With respect to your question, why she was cut and not called, I was not the trial counsel. I spoke to trial counsel yesterday. This is not obviously in the record. Trial counsel indicated that, as you can imagine with domestic disputes, sometimes the victim of such disputes have a difference of opinion down the road. At the time, the AUSA advised me for ethical reasons, she did not believe she could put on a witness who she believed might provide false testimony to the court. Mary Weaver was at the courthouse the whole time, and if the defendant wanted to call her, they could. The other thing that
Who calls in the domestic disturbance call?
Mary Weaver.
She's the one
who calls in the domestic disturbance call, calls in a 911 from the transcript.
So could you get that in? I mean, she just says, does the 911 or does the call say anything about
a
gun?
The call did not say anything about a gun.
Okay.
The call indicated that she wanted, I believe, her boyfriend out of the house and wanted her key back. There was, as I recall, there was no mention of the gun in the 911 call. The evidence at trial was that the first officer that responded within a minute and a half to 2 minutes to that call. As he's walking up to the house where Ms. Weaver is, she says he took the gun over there to that guy. Basically, that's the statement that we're all at issue about. One statement, he took the gun over to that guy and pointed to Mario Dowell. And that's what the officer did, went to Mr. Dowell. They eventually located the gun. A couple things. One, there are supposedly 14 instances of this hearsay. It's actually just one statement repeated different times. Four times it was raised by defense attorney in cross-examination. It was mentioned by the defense attorney in opening statement.
At that point, he may have thought the government was going to call her again.
He may have. But in closing argument, he also mentioned it. And at that time, obviously, all the evidence had been concluded, and he still brought up the statement. So, I mean, it's a tough road to hoe. You had an issue about the confrontation clause. The core to the confrontation clause, as the government understands it, is basically a distinction between testimonial and non-testimonial. And clearly, the statement made at that time was non-testimonial.
I wouldn't say clearly about that. I mean, it seems to me
in the government's opinion,
she could have been talking about a past event by then. It doesn't strike me as quite the 911 caller who says, you know, I've got a man with a gun standing right here.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think the court case, and I think it was the Davis case that involved a 911 call. There was another Supreme Court case where they made a distinction between what was happening at the events and trying to resolve the ongoing emergency versus law enforcement officers taking a statement sometime after the emergency had been resolved. If you're a law enforcement officer and you're walking out to the scene of a domestic disturbance and a person utters, that person took a gun that way to that and gave it to that person, as a law enforcement officer, you're not taking that down and thinking about a future trial testimony that this witness may give. You're thinking, I got to get that gun off the streets because that's a danger to me, that's a danger to the citizens on the street. So that's the distinction between testimonial and non-testimonial. This wasn't something that anybody was calculating, how is this going to play at a trial a year down the road. This was responding to the ongoing emergency of a domestic dispute that the officer did not know involved a gun by the dispatcher, by the 911 call. When he arrives at the scene, that's the first he's hearing of a gun, and he wanted to resolve that situation. So the government does not believe there was any confrontation clause problems because of the non-testimonial nature of that one statement. And again, we are talking about basically that one statement. If Your Honors have no more questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Norwood. Mr. Donovan, what time does he have? 3 minutes.
I do have a few points I would like to touch upon. First off, I just want to make it clear, I am arguing that the ability to declare a mistrial based on defendant's consent should be the defendant's consent and not the counsel's consent. Again, I put some case law in my reply brief of what makes a critical decision, and I do believe that this fulfills the factors of what should be a critical decision along with deciding on going to trial, whether to plead guilty, whether to appeal a case or represent oneself. So I just want to be clear that I am asking this court to make that a critical decision. I think it's interesting, we just heard from the government that we kind of now know why Mary Weaver wasn't called. He basically stated that they were afraid that she might provide perjurious testimony. So again, I go back to, it's awful convenient that they don't call her as a witness, but they still get to have her statements putting Mr. Taylor with a gun come into evidence. And again, he's correct, it is only one statement, but it comes in 14 times. I mean, this is a cumulative effect, and I think this is something that the jury heard over and over and over again.
The crux of his argument, though, really boils down to this assertion that we should regard this as a non-testimonial statement, all part of the ongoing emergency where the officers are focusing only on securing the gun, not, you know, in the luxury of the station house later saying, now, Ms. Weaver, you know, give us a fuller account of what happened.
And I don't think that is correct. I think it becomes clear that, again, this isn't a statement made during the 911 call. This is made after the officers arrive on the scene. Mr. Taylor is not at the scene when they arrive.
He's across the street. Isn't he heading back?
He heads back, and I think the officer's testimony was a few minutes later. So when he first arrives, he's not on the scene. It's just Mary Weaver. He makes no statements about her safety. Does she feel like she's in danger? Does she feel like that, you know, is she hurt? I think it clearly is made for a future investigation. I think clearly when the officer sees or hears that there might be a gun out there, he is immediately thinking, I want to track down the gun. The government's correct, but I think it is in light of a future prosecution that will take place later.
But why does he handcuff Taylor right away? I mean, he seems to be taking steps that would make one think he's really paying attention to the scene, not the future.
He says that he handcuffed Taylor for officer safety. Again, I think that's just a standard thing, but I think any officer that's investigating any sort of allegation like this has clearly got an eye towards an arrest, an investigation, and ultimately bringing it into court. So I believe it is testimonial.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Thompson. You were appointed, were you not?
That's correct.
So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you.
And we thank Mr. Norwood as well.